The rules of the game are that I'm supposed to introduce myself, so I will do that. My name is Vern Reike. I live in Seattle. I teach at the University of Washington in the School of Law. Among other courses, I teach a course in family law, and I teach a course entitled Child and the Law. The first course deals primarily with marriage, divorce, and things related to it. The second of the two courses deals with such things as adoption and juvenile court act and things which pertain primarily to children and the relation of children to their parents and to other persons and so forth. Erling is responsible for this.
And he
has, I'm sure, some ideas of what he would like to know, and perhaps some of you do. So I would like to begin tonight by saying I'd like to respond, if I can, to questions that you might have or things that you'd like to have some observations about. So I'm going to take a piece of chalk, and I'm going to listen very carefully while you tell me what you'd like to hear about, and I'll put down some things, then we'll talk about those for a while, and then if we run out, why, we'll get some more things, and so we'll proceed until about 10 minutes to 8 when we'll get up and go to chapel, okay? All right, what would you like to talk about?
Vern, why don't you give us the accurate statistics on marriage and divorce in the state of Washington?
All right, stats. For marriage and divorce.
And the U.S.
And the U.S.
All right, what else? Well, let's talk about those, and if we have lots of time left, why, we'll come back and talk about some other things too. I didn't plant Don's first question about statistics. However, I would be pleased to pass around to you, if you'll give them back to me, some trend lines which can do a better job for you in seeing what the marriage and divorce trends have been. That sheet that I'm passing around, I'm afraid, ends in 1977, but you can get kind of a decent idea from that about it. And Washington is fairly typical. So if I can answer the second half of Don's question about numbers, you will have at least a general idea. To do each of the 50 states independently, of course, would be impossible. besides, I don't have that kind of data with me. But you can generalize this way. The West Coast has the largest number, percentage-wise, of disillusions of marriage. The Midwest is the lowest, that is, marriages last longer and hopefully are more fun in the Dakotas than they are on the West Coast. And the East Coast is closer to being like the West Coast, but would be second. It's in the middle of the two. The important thing about the statistics that you read all the time about marriage and divorce is that they are usually stated in terms of how many divorces do you have to how many marriages. For example, in the state of Washington in 1978, we had 45,109, call it 45,000, licenses to marry. Presumably about that many couples got married. Although you don't know that. And in many states, and in this state until quite recently, you could have more than one marriage license going at a time. In fact, I used to wonder in some states whether they issued them sort of in blank, you know. John is hereby entitled to marry blank. You fill in as you find somebody. You can only have one name on one now in Washington, and it's only good for a limited period of time. We had 45,000 licenses to marry in 78, and in 78 we had 26,193 petitions to dissolve a marriage. You don't see statistics on the number of disillusions that occur in the statistics that you read. You see licenses to marry, and you see petitions to dissolve the marriage relationship. Now, in 1979, we had 47,000, that's 2,000 more, licenses to marry, and we had 26,888, that's about 600 more petitions to dissolve a marriage. I don't suppose that many of you could see this graph which I have drawn here. The upper line is marriages. It's got kind of a nice gentle rising, then it flattens out, and then it dips a little bit, and then it starts back up again. And the petitions to dissolve tracks along, and the important thing is that every time you hear this statistic, you hear somebody comparing this year's licenses to marry and this year's petitions to divorce, and really, no matter what you read in the magazines, people do not rush immediately from the auditor's license with a marriage license to the court to get a divorce. It takes a little while for it to break down. So if you want to do any accurate comparing at all, you ought to start comparing the 1981 petitions to dissolve a marriage with, let's say, the 1978 licenses to marry. And that gives you a very different picture, because our marriage rate rises and falls. You know, there are age groups that are going through. You see age groups closing schools right now because there are not enough kids. A few years ago, we were building schools like crazy because a bulge was going through. Well, all of those people going through getting married are going to have a very wonderful impact on the relationship between marriages and divorces, because people are going to be marrying like crazy for a while now. All of those just getting to the marriage age. On the other hand, there's a very slim group coming through that got married a few years ago, and people are going to be saying, we finally solved the problem, you know, the ratio is going down like crazy. False statistic. Plus the fact that about 20% of those petitions to dissolve a marriage are dismissed, and the marriage is never terminated. Please don't rejoice about that. Most of those 20% that are dismissed are people who have fought so long and so hard, and they've spent so much, and they've worn themselves out so much psychologically that they fall exhausted to the earth and can fight no more. That does not mean a reconciliation. Plus another very important fact. Remarriages have a substantially shorter life and a higher disillusion rate than do first marriages. There are a very substantial number of remarriages in the United States today. Now, I must be very careful here, and I don't want to overload your circuits. Remarriage is not more common today than it was, let's say, a century ago. But the circumstances of the remarriage are very different. A century ago, people remarried because a spouse died at a relatively young age, and there were children, and the whole economic, social situation virtually demanded marriage. There were no viable options. And people married, and that marriage was almost as good as a first marriage. That's no longer true. Today, remarriages have a substantially weaker link, and the dissolution rate is significantly higher than it is in first marriages. If you take first marriages in the United States, the first time a couple are married, the last census showed that about 72% of those marriages would continue to the death of one of the spouses. That's a far cry from the kind of statistic that you hear about, you know. What you're seeing then is a phenomenon of comparing the wrong year with the right year and ignoring the fact of multiple marriages, ignoring the fact that you are comparing petitions to dissolve and licenses to marry rather than accomplished facts. And also another very important thing, we're living longer, substantially longer than we used to, and therefore we're getting a whole bunch of people who are divorcing at an older age, simply because both of them are living longer, that's all. It used to be that you didn't have to worry about it. Somebody would die in a few years. And then one final clincher on this one. This one is very hard to get statistics on, and I can quickly tell you more than I know about this. But that's all right, I'll do it anyway. Prior to about 1965 or so, maybe 1970 even, at a time when dissolution marriage was still very difficult to accomplish, before no fault and all of this kind of thing, because it was such a painful experience to divorce, much more so than now, and expensive, and long, and embarrassing, and everybody sneered at you, many people elected to separate, but not to terminate their marriage officially. The one study that I've seen which seems to have some empirical basis out of California indicated that back about a decade and a half ago, if you took three marriages, that before those six people died, there would be one divorce of those three marriages, there would be one separation without dissolution of marriage, and one couple would hang in there till one of them died. Well, that gives you a 2 out of 3 zap with one good one. What's the situation today? Let's say that, let's take California. Let's say that 1 out of 2 ratio is quite accurate. If there are no separations, that's good, we've made an improvement. So how many separations are there? I don't know. But probably fewer percentage-wise than there were a decade ago for the very simple reason that the dissolution process is cleaner, faster, cheaper than it used to be. And I rather suspect that there are a substantial number of people who used to separate without terminating. I don't think there are so many doing that anymore. And so probably we haven't lost any ground if you're thinking about people who continue to live together. It's just the way in which the data is collected and reported.
Doesn't the expense have something to do with that? It's too expensive to separate
and go
through all that
bit and trying to collect it. It is more expensive today for people who want to contest the dissolution of their marriage. It's more expensive because we see people, I'm talking now about people who want to argue about it, people who cannot agree and by contract divide their property and agree upon support and agree upon custody and so forth. Because when that question comes, then we need evidence now about the division of assets. For example, what's the goodwill of a business? In order to know that, the couple's attorney is, or the attorney for one of the spouses is going to have to employ an actuary or an accountant and have a study done to establish goodwill. What's the present value of a pension plan to which you have been contributing for 15 years but will not realize any payments for another 10 years? and the present value is to be divided now, not by agreement, but by presentation of evidence as to its present value in an order of the court. In order to come up with anything other than a rough guess, you're going to have to employ an actuary. It's going to cost you $800 to $1,000 to get a number on that. Now, I can go on with this sort of thing, and you very quickly can build a fee expense bill, not for the attorney, but for your expert witnesses that you pull in, of a very substantial amount of money. And that's a deterrent. That's a lot of those 20% that I was talking about, who finally are bankrupt and psychotic. And then they dismiss their action, and we rejoice because, by golly, we reconciled another couple. Of course, they're not going to talk to each other again ever. That's bad news. Now, I don't know whether I've answered your question or not about this first one on statistics. I can read you lots of numbers. But what has happened is that marriages have increased, and because marriage causes divorce, divorces increase. When marriages come down, a couple years later, divorce goes down. When marriages go back up, divorce goes back up. Now, it's true that the ratio is increasing. They're getting more per thousand, more per thousand married, but not nearly as dramatically as the sort of crude statistic, 45,000 marriages, 26,000 divorces this year. That's really an almost irrelevant number. And don't fall for it. Anybody want to cross-examine before I pick up the next one? Okay, the second thing we've got up here is areas of particular difficulty in the dissolution process. I happen to be loaded for that one. I have just gone through the process of culling out all of the appellate decisions in the state of Washington for the last 10 years in both our Court of Appeals, which is our first Court of Appeal, and then our Supreme Court, and have analyzed the issues that were placed before the court on an appeal. That's some indication of what's going on. Here I digress for a moment to tell you that that's not going to be a very good statistic. I'm going to give it to you. It's not going to be a very good one for this reason, that there are not very many dissolution of marriage cases appealed. It's a rare phenomenon. In civil actions generally, we have one appeal for about every 50 cases. It's tried in the trial courts. In dissolution of marriage, we have one appeal for about every 800. So I'm now going to tell you all about the gnat, and the elephant goes wallowing around down here, not reflected very well in this statistic, except for the fact that if people really are they've got their backs up enough to appeal a decision of dissolution of the trial court, we may be getting something which is a little bit more accurate than I've just indicated. Far and away, two areas dominate everything else. That is custody of children, including visitation rights, and the division of property. Those are the two areas which cause the greatest difficulty by far. Within that, those two areas, the custody of children. Well, let's talk a little bit about one of the items a little further down here at the same time, that is joint custody. Same time. Joint custody is real big right now. Brand new in Washington, beginning in 1889. And we had our first joint custody awards prior to the First World War, approved by our Supreme Court. Joint custody then began to fade in popularity and also in the decisions of the court for the reason that it didn't seem to solve the people's problems. Plus the fact that there was a rising social trend at that time that children, especially young children, ought to be with their mothers. It was called the Tender Years Doctrine. And there was almost an absolute presumption that young children had to go to their mothers. That was interesting because at a few years earlier, there was virtually an absolute presumption that children had to go to their fathers. So you try one thing and then you try another thing. Well, we've left the Tender Years Doctrine, and in recent years we are using what is called a rule which is decide the issue of custody in the best interest of the child. What's in the best interest of the child? Now that's a very interesting problem. One way to do that would be to ask the child. And we're beginning to do that a little bit. Another way would be to have somebody who has some expertise in that area, social worker, child psychologist, child psychiatrist, somebody else, investigate, make a report to the judge, put the evidence in. That's got some problems with it. I think it's very helpful at times, but we're back to the old expense account at that place. The meter runs like crazy when this is happening. And then when you get the evidence in, you're not so sure that, be with you in just a second, you're not so sure that the evidence is all that reliable. Well, mothers get custody of the children in about 94% of the cases. A few years later, at least 15 to 20% of the children are in the custody of the father, indicating a pretty fast shift of custody from one to the other. Most recently, what is happening is that more fathers are getting custody than ask for it. Women are now saying in their petitions for divorce, terminate the marriage, divide the property, and give custody of the children to the father, because I'm going to have to work just like he's going to have to work. There's no more reason why I ought to work 8 hours a day and then come home and take care of the kids. Especially when the amount of child support that's going to be ordered is inadequate and he's not going to pay it anyway. You give the children to the father, let him work a double shift, order me to pay, and he can try and collect from me. And it's very sad to read those cases and see that this is what's going on. Now, the way to a palliative for one's sense of decency at this point is to say joint custody. Now, joint custody is a way of sort of feeling better about it, you know. Let's both be responsible for the child. And let's both take care of the child. And we'll figure it out. Sometimes the child will live with me a week and then with you a week. A number of couples that I know in Seattle have done it the other way. They've got two apartments, one with two bedrooms, one with one. Mother and child moves into the two-bedroom apartment for 1 week, and then she moves to the one-bedroom apartment. The father moves into the two-bedroom apartment. The child stays in his own room, own bed the whole time, and parents move in and out. Rather than moving the kid, they move the parents. There's all kinds of experimentation going on here, some of which I think is good, and I think for some folks that's a good idea. From 1972 to 1980, we went from less than 2% joint custody in the state of Washington to over 13% joint custody awards, and I'm sure it's increasing rapidly from that time on. And we may very well repeat the experience of 1910 to 1930. You know, it's like everything else. You wear your hair long and then you wear it short, and you wear it long again and you wear it short. And we experiment with these things. I promised.
Okay. Yeah. Is there any circumstance under which the court would award the children to neither, but make them award
indeed
the court?
Indeed. We now have a rather significant, not yet large, but a fairly significant number of cases in what's known as third-party custody cases. in which a grandparent or an uncle or an aunt or a foster parent, somebody else, will appear in the action at the time of dissolution and say that this child's best interests will be better served by awarding custody to me rather than to either one of the parents. The law of this state and the law of a number of states, all those states which have adopted that section of the Uniform Marriage and Divorce Act, have the possibility of third-party custody actions. There are two steps to this now. Step number one is what I'm going to label for the moment standing. Does that third person have any standing to make this request? You know, you can't just walk in off the street and sit in the divorce court for a while until you see a child that looks kind of good and say, I'll take that one. You've got to be related in some way. You've got to have some kind of an interest. And you have to show in most states that neither parent is a suitable custodian for the child. The other step is, if you can show that you have reason for standing, then you've got to show that indeed the child's interests will be best served by being in your custody rather than that of either parent. The state of Washington has a decision within the last month and a half on precisely this point, and it's appearing now in a number of states. I have seen not less than a dozen from other states in the last 6 months, so it's becoming rather common. The trade-off that's going on here is this. It used to be that in order to take a child from parents, you had to show what's typically called unfit in the juvenile court. The parent is just a loser all the way, just plain unfit. Notice the subtle difference, because in the dissolution action, if you can come in and ask for custody, the standard is not that the parents are unfit, but rather that the child's best interests suggest you rather than the parent. And that's a very different test. Both parents may be fit people, but if grandpa, and what really could be better in life than a good grandfather? If you like to see the picture? If grandpa can show that the child's best interests are served with an award of custody to the grandfather or grandmother or to both of them, than to the parents, why the grandparents will win. It's a very significant difference. The other area of difficulty, property. The big difficulty there is, what is property? That's what all the litigation is about. Is a pension property? The United States Supreme Court very recently decided that military retirement pay is not property that can be divided. It's retired pay, and under the Act of Congress, it belongs to the service person, whether that's woman or man, and you can't divide it, nor can you take it into consideration when you divide the rest of the property. Oh boy, that's rugged, you know. If you've got one spouse who's been in service for 20 years, and that spouse is going to retire to the happy ground of military retired pay, and you have a house that's worth $100,000, and the split comes, and you want to divide the property, a judge is tempted to say that, well, she has retirement pay as a former military person, and she's well taken care of, so I'll give the whole house to the husband who doesn't have that kind of resource. Tilt, can't do that. Congress has said that the military person gets that pay, and nobody touches it, and you don't take it into consideration dividing the other assets. So also with retirement pay. So also with any pension plans in private employers, which are governed by the federal law protecting the integrity of insurance plans, maybe. That one is being fought with a couple dozen cases that are wending their way around the various courts now to see whether or not that great bulk, you know, that's Boeing and all the major corporations the United States have set up, pension plans. That's what's going on in the property area right now.
plus goodwill. Here I am, a lawyer. I can't sell my practice. Nobody can buy my practice. But there's no doubt that, well, I shouldn't use myself because I probably don't have any goodwill. Many lawyers do have clients who think they're all right and they'll come back again. That's kind of goodwill. The lawyer has the misfortune of being divorced and they don't have an awful lot of assets, but the wife says, you got $100,000 worth of goodwill and I want half of it. The lawyer says, I haven't got it. She says, well, that's all right, I'll take it over time. Just give it to me now. Is goodwill property? Answer to that is yeah. Is an education property? Wife puts husband through medical school.
Yes.
She starts pounding the typewriter just as soon as she gets out of high school. You know, that's when they get married. And she pounds the typewriter and earns money and feeds him all the way through college and all the way through med school, all the way through residency. And he finally is ready to cut and making $100,000 a year. And he looks at her and says, you know, I never realized this before, but you are not even a college graduate. And you certainly aren't up to par with my style of living. And so they split. And she says, I want half his property. And he says, well, fortunately, you ask now rather than later, because I'm just coming into my earning years. I'll give you half of what I got. And she says, I want half of the value of your education. Is that property?
Yes.
Now let's hear from the men. Or let's hear from the medics, I guess. A number of courts have decided that a professional education, medicine, dentistry, law, educations of that sort, are property and are capable of division. So far, the guy who's good with a hammer and saw doesn't get treated that way. Yet. There are a lot of spouses who have not been the earning spouses who are looking at the other one. Well, you've got this wonderful skill of being a nurse. Or, my dear, you've got this wonderful skill of bookkeeping. And you're one of the best female bookkeepers in the city of Seattle. And I want half of the value. Now that's questions. See, those kinds of questions are coming up as to what is property. I like one case that I read recently of a alienation of affection suit. Yeah, a man's affections were alienated. And I mean, he ran away with another woman. His wife sues the other woman for alienation of affections and gets a rather good judgment. And then gets a divorce. And he says, well, you got this judgment during the time that we were married. And my love and affection, obviously, was something that belonged to the marriage. Therefore, the money is in lieu of something which belonged to the marriage, and I get half of it. But he did. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful? Yeah. So we've got these cases boiling around. There is one professor on the campus at the University of Washington who probably will never speak to me again. He wrote a book that he had been working on for a long time, a very good book in his field especially. And he's got royalties coming in for a long time. That's when the divorce came. And the wife said, well, all of those royalties, of course, already received, and those in the future are property to be divided now. That's the way it came up. And so he's there, half of every royalty check, he sends it to his ex. It's property available for present distribution. Those are the kinds of cases. That's the major area of dispute right now. Children's custody and what is property. Yes, sir.
That area of difficulty brought to mind my curiosity about, maybe you can cover this quickly. What, do you have to cite the problem in petitioning for distribution initially and today?
You ask for certain kinds of relief in your petition. You say that
Is there a cause stated? Does one spouse sue the other for divorce based on the general topic, irreconcilable differences or infidelity?
Yes. In many states today, all but a couple, there will be at least an optional ground that says that the marriage is irretrievably broken or that there are irreconcilable differences. Most states still have other grounds too, like adultery or personal indignities rendering life burdensome or something of that sort. But in all but a couple of states, you have this ground of just irretrievably broken. So the grounds for divorce, practically non-existent. Litigation about that has almost disappeared.
So we don't know anymore.
Yeah, that's right. And in many states, the law will expressly state that fault, and who's the good guy and who's the bad guy, is not to be a factor in things like dividing property and awarding custody. Because whether or not one of them was a good spouse or not ought not to be important in terms of assets and children's welfare and so forth. There seems to be a mean streak in most of us that when a marriage has gotten to a place where it is collapsing, that there has to be a little catharsis. You got to scream and yell someplace. And so much of that kind of fighting today, instead of arguing about grounds, goes over to fight about custody, for example. She is obviously not a good person to have custody. She does all of these wicked things, bad things. I'm not saying it's her fault. It's just that she's got bad habits. And so you get that kind of infighting going on over there. We've shifted the locale.
I'm glad that you've explained with all these complexities why these things are so expensive.
That's a lawyer talking.
On joint custody, you indicated that there seems to be a significant rise in joint custody cases. Yeah. Is there any statistics to show how many of those are actually joint custody and how many are more joint custody in name, but really no difference in action? A lot of times I think we end up with joint custody, although it's really simple.
I'm afraid that the statistics are not yet in, Les. It is, I think, pretty predictable that joint custody really means in 3/4 of the cases, is my guess. Visitation for the whole summer or something of that sort.
Sounds better.
Yeah, that's right. It sounds better. And of course, the snapper in joint custody is that I hereby award joint custody to the husband and wife with physical custody to the wife. That means that the husband can be consulted on anything that he ought to be consulted about. Therefore, it will be just about like it was before they were divorced. It is of some significance, don't misunderstand me. The child can no longer enlist in the army or get married or do some other things without the consent of both parents, perhaps, given state. If there is legal custody for both spouses. Now, lest I pass that off too quickly, there are some psychological advantages in joint custody. If both parents can be made to feel that they are still cooperating and communication is open and will work at it, that's fine. And it will work in some cases. And it's a great thing. Because although you terminate the relationship between the husband and wife, in a divorce action, you do not terminate the relationship between the parent and the child. That's still a parent and parent-child relationship in there. And if the child can be given the advantage of both parents, even in this new setting, sometimes it can be worked out very well. The best study on this one indicates that when joint custody works, it really is very good for the children. The success rate is, it's a little too early to tell yet. I'm going to take a few years to find out. One thing is that it's a great thing for judges. Judges throw themselves around terribly about custody decisions. How would you like to do that? Well, King Solomon had joint custody in mind, you know, he said, cut the child in half, give one half to each. Well, it's kind of divided custody, I guess. He didn't want to wrestle with that problem, neither do judges today. It is a gut-rending problem for judges to decide custody. How would you like to do that? Especially on totally inadequate information. So you give a judge an option like joint custody and they'll go for it like a trout for a fly.
And that doesn't mean it's a good thing. It just means that it's an easy out for everybody. Yes?
I can speak to that both as a lawyer and a parent who has joint custody. And I think that, like I say, it's not a panacea. But I think that, especially when you're in a situation where you go into a dissolution situation from the beginning, talking about joint custody, it not only works out better for the kids in the long run, it also, I think, enables the two spouses who are dissolving a marriage to cooperate more in some other areas. I mean, because you've already made the decision that you're going to have to deal with one another on a long-term basis. There are an awful lot of little picky items that can get to be, as you probably well know, blown way out of proportion.
Sure.
But if you keep knowing that you've got to deal with this person for a number of years, I think that that has a side effect that it's also of some worth. And I think it's also really of some benefit to have each spouse realize that he or she is going to have a continuing responsibility for those kids. And in my case, certainly, I think it's been something that's worked out very well. Now, as far as being, you know, custody in name only, joint custody, I guess you could say that. I think as a practical matter, it's better for kids to at least be living with one spouse or the other probably through the school year. So it ends up, you can call it, you know, it's just a 3-month visitation. But I think if you don't look at it in those terms, and especially if you have a situation where you're lucky enough to have both of the spouses living in the same geographical area, it can really, you know, pretty meaningfully be a joint custody kind of situation. I think in very possible kind of situations, it's probably just something that's not going to work. But
when it works, it's good. When it doesn't, it's not. Well, we've been getting the bad news about this one so far. Now let me give you the good news.
People don't pay much attention to what court orders anyway. In the materials that I use in teaching this course, I have 5 decisions of the state Supreme Court on custody. And I decided one day to call the lawyers and ask how the custody that was ordered was working out in that flow. I just see whether or not it was a good decision and so forth. In 4 of the 5 cases, by the time the Supreme Court issued its order, the circumstances had changed enough so that the decision of the Supreme Court was irrelevant to the situation and was completely ignored. 4 of the 5 cases, the two parents involved simply made the arrangements of their own and said, well, that's a nice thing for the court to write about, but you don't sue me to enforce it and I won't sue you and we'll work out another deal, et cetera. So we've got some beautiful law sitting out here, masterfully written opinions, which don't apply to any real life situation because they came 2 years later. Yeah. So that's kind of nice. And you've got to keep that in mind. This is an area in which 5 deals are very, very common. And,
Vern, because of that, isn't there a movement afoot to remove this type of litigation from the judicial system? In fact, isn't that happening in some states?
Yes. And down here, we have a question that says, what's the lawyer's opinion of marriage counselors? And those of you who are in this area, either as counselors or as lawyers, will know that environment has changed greatly. Lawyers today are looking for mediators, people who have the skill to help people sit and talk and work out their own problems. In this state and in many states, the law expressly provides that the persons involved, the adults, husband and wife, may by contract determine many of the issues and can suggest and therefore virtually decide other issues like custody and visitation and so forth. And the court will almost automatically approve and make part of its decree what the parties want to do. Now, the difficulty is getting the two parties to talk to each other. And a skilled mediator, that can be a social worker, it can be a psychologist, it can be a pastor, it can be a lawyer, anybody that knows how to do this kind of thing, can help people work out these difficulties and come up with solutions. And they are much better than a court-ordered solution. Number one, because he knows more about the situation than the people who are immediately involved. Number two is the chances of observing the arrangement that's worked out is greatly enhanced if it's my agreement rather than something that the guy in the black robe told me I had to do. So your enforcement problems go down, functioning probabilities go up, and the attitude today on both sides of the two disciplines, that is, counseling discipline, the lawyer discipline, is much more open one than it's true, and it's going to be much better. The suggestion that we might be taking much of the marriage and divorce stuff out of law totally, I think must be reckoned with. I think this may happen. Now, if you get a fight about who owns the property, go to the judge and fight about who owns the property. That's a totally different question than how Jane and John are going to get along with each other. Separation without final termination. I suspect you'd find that in the books of most states today, but you will not find it used very often. We have 46,000 divorces in a year. We may have as many as 100 such decisions, where people want to be legally separated with an order of how to do it, but not have their marriage relations technically terminated.
How
did
you
bring
that
to
say a
life marriage without marriage getting
divorced?
Oh, I see. Well, that's been a very tremendous case. You know, from state to state, and in the United States, unlike those of you from Canada, where you have a federal law that governs marriage and divorce, we don't in the United States. Every state does its own thing. We get a great variation down here. If I had a guess, I'd guess that you would find this situation probably in half our state yet, where the husband is the owner of the property, and at the time of the termination of marriage, the husband is asked to take it over. The wife couldn't get very late. Well, that's not true here. It's not true in any community property state. And it's not true in many other states. And in those states which have adopted the Uniform Marriage and Divorce Act, that act was promulgated in 1972. And I guess maybe a quarter of the states have adopted it now. Even though they are not community property states, they now have what is known as putative marital property, which comes out to be essentially the same thing as marriage as community property, and therefore the wife should be protected. So the trend is clearly toward a much better, much fairer deal for the wife than it was before, but I'm sure she still comes out in the short end in the bank conversation.
Could you just follow up with a comment as far as the King Neil Alamon, who mentioned at least if it had to be true, but I'm going to follow up on it a little bit.
What used to be called alimony, that is a substitution of the spouse's obligation to support after marriage other money, alimony, now called spousal maintenance or some such name in many states, is a decreasing factor. You get it used in those cases in which there is no present property to be divided, and one spouse is simply incapable of providing for his or her support, and the other spouse has to pay. That spouse. Don't know that's a good idea, incidentally. Maybe that ought to be some of the social tragedy that we pick up with taxpayers generally. But that's what is being done currently. to the war, you get about 6% of the cases will involve a spousal maintenance award and things like that. There are many. Hard to collect. There may be more. Very shortly. Because of the difficulties that I've already discussed in reference to what is property. If you get to the place where it becomes almost impossible to divide property without a tremendous hassle, or if our major assets, retirement programs, pensions, those kinds of things, are all preempted by federal law so that a state court can't divide them, then you have no choice but to use alimony or maintenance payments for the support of the one spouse doesn't have assets. One thing you know for sure is that every time there's a dissolution, both spouses will take about a 15% drop in their level of living. You can't have two concerns going at once. You got it quick, but I one more thing. Cohabitation. I have no idea whether there's more cohabitation going on without marriage now than was true 50 years ago. I just don't know. Nobody told me how many people were living without the benefit of marriage 50 years ago. Common law marriages, that is, if you live with somebody, holding your child out of marriage, you used to be married after a period of notoriety. Some states now are trying to address the cohabitation thing by saying that a couple who look like they're married and act like they're married and talk like they're married are married after some period of time. The one state that I know that had good experience with that before it became a state was Alaska. They had a 90-day law. You live with somebody for 90 days and you were married. It led to a phenomenon which was commonly called by construction crews the 89-day shuffle. Everybody moved one bed to the left. I'm told by those in the know that about the 80th day, people began to get haircuts and bathe and sign up. And everybody left real attractive for these
weeks. In how many states
Very few now, very few. There's no question what we have gone into a time of non-married but lawful relationships. You don't get the advantages of a package program for inheritance and earnings and the rest of those things. I think that I can honestly state that we are seeing about as much difficulty in the termination of the cohabitation relationship if it's been for a very long period, both psychologically and in terms of arguing about the property. It's not easy just to get up and walk away. And these are giving us very real problems now. However, it is having one, if I'm to good news, it apparently is having one good effect. And that is that people who are not committed to a long-term marriage are cohabiting for a while, and as a result, the average duration of marriages, I can speak only about those that come to dissolution court, is actually going up. People who are getting their divorces now have been married a longer time, probably because they were more seriously committed to the idea of marriage in the first place. The one-nighters don't bother to go.